You're listening to CGLO 1690 AM in Montreal. Hello, and welcome to another episode of The Squeaky Curd, a food show coming to you from CGLO, where we examine our relationship with food here in Montreal. I'm your host, Gwen Rowley. I'm a journalism grad student at Concordia, and I am not a food expert. I just like to eat. Today, we'll be looking at food deserts, what they are, and how that definition has changed, how they exist in Montreal, and how they compare to food deserts in other parts of the world. Much like the episode last week, where we covered urban agriculture, the theme for this week's episode has already made some guest appearances on the show before. Food deserts are intrinsically tied to ideas about food security and food justice because it is defined as an area where people have limited access to consistent, nutritious food within a reasonable distance from their dwelling. The lack of access to food ties to food security because when you don't have access to food, you are food insecure. But the concept of a food desert also ties into food justice because where you live and what you have access to is tied to other factors beyond geography, such as class, gender, and education. Historically speaking, and just when you hear people talking about food deserts in general, we are often referring to things in a geographical sense. This neighborhood has this many people and this many stores, and that's not enough to keep everyone well-fed with nutritious food, so it is therefore a food desert. I talked to Richard Shermer from McGill University, who attempted to study and qualify food deserts in Montreal in the aughts to learn more about how we would pinpoint food deserts in the city.
Okay, I'm Richard Shermer. I am a professor at the McGill School of Urban Planning, and I am currently its director as well, and I'm he.
Here's how Richard would define a food desert.
Well, this was a big issue that we were dealing with because, conceptually, and when we talk sort of quickly, a food desert is a neighborhood from which people have difficulty in accessing food stores. So it's a geographic concept. It's focusing on neighborhoods and is trying to say, well, which neighborhoods or from which neighborhoods will people have difficulty in accessing food stores? So that's really the best definition that I can give you, sort of a general definition. But the devil is in the detail, because first of all, when we say accessing food stores, what do we mean exactly? So if we just focus on accessing food stores, do we mean accessing by car or accessing on foot? Typically, we mean accessing on foot, but we'll come back to that. But typically, it's accessing on foot, and then we say, well, okay, who are we talking about? Are we talking about young, fit people who can easily walk a mile? Are we talking about sort of middle-aged people who may find it hard to walk a kilometer? Are we talking about people with who are living with sort of physical mobility challenges who may find it hard to walk 200 meters? And then we're talking about buying groceries. So we can maybe walk a kilometer, but how many groceries do we have to carry home? Do we carry home lots of bags, in which case even young fit people may find it hard to walk 400 meters? Or are we talking about just buying a carton of milk, in which case maybe a mile is no issue? So the minute that we start, and all these, it may seem like nitpicking, but when we're talking about how do people access food, and we're just talking about geographic access here, actually it is a really complex issue just to even understand what we mean by access.
When Richard was conducting his research, this is how he went about collecting his data.
Yeah, so a number of years ago, this is like over 10 years ago, so it's not current, but I think conceptually it's still perfectly valid. I did some research with some colleagues at the INRS on food deserts. And really what we were trying to do is say, well, how can these be identified, empirically? How can we identify, how can we go from the concept to actually identifying them on the ground? And then we use Montreal as our test bed, so to speak. So we went from the idea to measurement, which is in fact what I'll be talking about, because this is something which is not an easy thing to do. And once we had tried to sort of, once we had approximately found a way of measuring it, then we used Montreal data to see if indeed we could identify food deserts in the Montreal area. And so the food deserts that the data that we were looking at were 2006 or 2010. I can't remember exactly which year the census data were, but I know that our data for stores was around 2008 or 2009.
Basically, they would look at city blocks in Montreal as their test unit, draw an 800-meter radius around it, and take note of whether there was a food store within that range that people living on that block had access to. Even with this empirical definition, they were finding it difficult to define certain areas as food deserts.
You know, is it enough just to have one food store? What size of food store is required? If there's just one food store, maybe there's a monopoly. So maybe actually for it not to be a food desert, you need two or three food stores. What do those food stores sell? You know, typically there's when we talk about food deserts, it's also access to good food. So it's not really enough just to have a dépanneur selling beer and crisps. What you really need is a store which is selling a variety of healthy foods, and that's typically thought of as fresh vegetables, fruits, you know, milk, maybe meat and things like that. So often we're looking for proximity to a largish grocery store. And I insist on the ish when I say large, because it's approximately, how do you define a large grocery store which would make an area accessible or make food accessible? But even then it's problematic, because when you actually visit metro stores, you realize that they have different food in different neighborhoods. You know, if you go to a metro store out in Hochelaga, they actually have quite a different variety of foods than they do, say, where I live near Snowdon. And it's partly to respond to local cultural differences, but it's also partly to respond to the various income groups and the taste of the people who live there. And so, you know, you may actually find that some largish grocery stores don't actually have as much variety as you think they do. So you can see that the minute you begin to try and empirically measure what a food desert is, you run into major issues.
Because when it comes down to it, geography doesn't exist on its own in a vacuum. A neighborhood location isn't the only reason why it would be considered a food desert. Even a neighborhood that has a very low access to food might not be considered a food desert because all of its residents are affluent people who have cars who would easily be able to go to a grocery store and purchase food and bring it back to their homes.
The idea is that certain neighborhoods, often neighborhoods with lower income levels, are actually shunned, don't have a good food provision. But the real issue then is not so much maybe physical access to food, it's access financially. Can you buy food? Because you may have a store next door, but if food is too expensive, you're not going to use it. And it also may be actually just having access to a car, which is the issue. Because one of the things that we definitely saw in our studies is that when you apply the geographic concept, the areas which are most isolated from food are actually fairly well-off suburbs, the middle-class suburbs. When you move to the suburbs of the island, and we actually were just looking at the island, we weren't looking off island, but when you go to places like Kirkland, you know, in the west end of the island, there are major food deserts. But nobody worries about those food deserts because we know that people there have cars. Even I think the Summit Circle in Westmount was a food desert, you know, because it's actually quite a long way from grocery stores, but everybody there has a car.
When I was talking to Richard, he pointed out several times that his research, while still relevant, was a bit dated. So I also reached out to Marion Ertz at the University of Quebec at Chicoutimi, who started research on food deserts in 2016.
My name is Miriam Ertz. I'm a professor in marketing at the University of Quebec at Chicoutimi. And I'm also the director of the Laboratory of Research on New Forms of Consumption, which is the Labo NFC.
Here's Miriam talking about why she started to look into food deserts.
The research that I did on food deserts was in 2016. Well, I started in 2016, and I saw the concept somewhere in an article, and I remember that it struck me because, especially in a urban setting, I was surprised to know that in some parts of, you know, huge, densely populated city with a lot of companies, a lot of people, there were actually some places where people didn't have access to enough food, or at least to nutritious and healthy food. And I found that quite interesting, especially in what we call rich country like Canada, or even in other developed countries. I was a bit surprised to know that this kind of issue is actually an issue in such countries.
And here's how she would define a food desert.
Food deserts are places where access to nutritious and healthy food is limited. So it's not that there is no food. There is food, but the quality, there is quantity, but there is no quality. The quality of the food is perhaps not as good as in other areas. So, for example, there are no, like, for example, bakeries, butchers that offer fresh, specialized products. There are perhaps only small stores and gas stations or small supermarkets, what we call dépanneurs in Quebec.
Much like Richard, she found geography not to be the only aspect at play in qualifying a food desert.
And actually, after the study, this kind of geographical conception of food deserts actually was not that relevant anymore, because we realized that it's not so much about geographical access to quality stores, let's say. You could have access to them, but it's more about other variables that enter into play. So, of course, the geographical aspect is important. That's for sure. But there are also other limitations, like, for example, the education about food education, for example. Having information about the foods, the vegetables, knowing them. Some people sometimes don't know the names of some foods or some vegetables. They don't know them at all. They don't know how to cook them. And so it's this lack of food education, actually. So information, knowing some recipes, having followed some cooking classes, that is actually lacking. That's a first big variable. And then there are also some other aspects which are perhaps a bit less impactful, but that have still some importance as well, is product diversification also. So to have, for example, access to local products, or to have access to organic products. So products that you might not necessarily find in a conventional supermarket. So that's also something that can be of an issue. And of course, that's kind of correlated with, again, the geographical factor, because that actually takes us back to the logistical problem of having access to stores that offer this kind of diversity. And it's not only stores, it can also be other channels. And that's going to lead me to my third point. So the first one was food education, then the second one was product diversification, and the third one is supply, and basically the marketing aspect. And like we talked about earlier, so the fact of having, for example, access to short food circuits, like, for example, farmers market, locavore markets, and this kind of gatherings or groupings. So this is also a third aspect that is very important. It's kind of related to the geographical aspect, but it's still something else because it's a bit more dynamic. It really talks about the supply chain and Yeah, basically the whole distribution aspect of products.
When we come back from the break, we'll be looking at how these three areas of food deserts, geography, supply, and education, interact with each other, as well as other social factors like class and sex in Montreal. You're listening to CGLO 1690 AM in Montreal. Hello, and welcome back to The Squeaky Curd. Today, we're looking at the concept of food deserts and how they interact with different social issues in Montreal. Before the break, we examined how the traditional explanation of a food desert existing just within geographical bounds didn't seem to address other issues that might prevent people from having access to consistent, nutritious food. Marian Ertz expanded on the definition of food deserts for us by adding to the factor of geography, supply, and education. In this segment, we'll be looking at the concept of food deserts in Montreal from these three angles. To start off, we'll be looking at geography. Before we zoom in and look at how location in a city plays into access to food, let's take a macro approach and look at how the planning and placement of cities and villages within your country and its food supply system can even have an effect on easy access to food. Miriam grew up in France and offered this comparison between France and Canada, which is far more spread out and less densely populated.
In both countries, what you can see is that if you're in a rural area, no matter if it's a rich or poor country, it can be considered a food desert in a sense, because there are no supermarkets. It's not even a question of healthy or not. There is nothing. It's very rare to see some stores in small villages or in small towns. But the difference starts to appear, I think, in urban areas. And in urban areas, in contrast to villages where you still can, for example, sometimes have access to a farmer or to someone who's actually cultivating some produce, in the urban area, you're really cut off of everything, in a sense. So in both countries, there are instances of neighborhoods that have food deserts. Again, it's very highly correlated with neighborhood level of poverty, especially in poorer neighborhoods. Although they have a high population density, we have a very low store density, or at least healthy store density. And in both countries, you can see that. But it sometimes seems to be much stronger in North America, especially because the relationship between the farmers and the population in cities, in urban areas, is much less frequent than in France, for example. In France, you can go in a big city and you will always find a place somewhere where every week you see, for example, some farmers markets or some short circuits, let's say it more generally like that, short circuits, or even associations or groupings of consumers who enter into contact with farmers. It's much more frequent there, especially in urban areas. Whereas in North America, I don't really know why, but in big cities, and even in smaller scale cities, for example, I come from Chicoutimi. It's not a big city like Montreal or Quebec, but still, you know, it's a mid-level city, let's say, two-tier city or three-tier, I don't know. And even there, we have a lack of this kind of markets. It doesn't really exist. But I think you can extrapolate that in the whole of Quebec, in the whole of Canada, is we have a very big territory, huge territory, but we have a very small population density. However, if you want to construct a market, you have to have high population density, because at the end of the day, it's the meeting of an offer and a demand. And if you have a low density, then it will be difficult to do that match, because people will be scattered all around, you know, this huge territory. And it's highly inefficient to ask them to come each in one place. So that's also why here in Quebec, I noticed that what became very popular, instead of farmers markets in the traditional sense, are the food boxes that farmers actually send directly by mail to the consumer at their home. So that's really popular. It's increasingly popular. It's also gaining popularity in other countries and in other areas, but I found that it's very, very popular here in Quebec, in contrast to other more traditional circuits, like I said before, farmers markets or markets in general in a traditional sense.
When people talk about food deserts, they are often referring to urban or at least more densely populated areas. But it's important to note that what is happening outside of a city, in a province, or in a country also plays a role into how the people in that city will have access to food. But now we're going to zoom in and focus on the city and define how your location in that city affects your access to food. To learn more about Montreal and food deserts, I talked to Christina Wolf, the co-president of Meal Care, a food rescue program at McGill.
So my name's Christina Wolf. My pronouns are she, her, and I am an international development undergrad student at McGill. I'm also co-president of Meal Care McGill.
Meal Care collects and redistributes surplus food from restaurants and grocery stores to shelters and food banks.
So I guess maybe just a little bit on Meal Care is that Meal Care is a student organization at McGill. It was founded in 2016. And we look to reduce food insecurity in Montreal by reducing food waste and also educating people about food insecurity and things surrounding that. So that kind of opened my eyes, my work with Meal Care, to issues of food insecurity in Montreal, and specifically what where I've kind of applied it is I'm minoring in social entrepreneurship. So I've done a lot of research into how social entrepreneurship and the nonprofit plural sector can address this issue, because it's not really being adequately addressed by the public sector or the private sector.
Christina also talked about how, when looking at food deserts as physical locations on a map of a city, we need to consider other social factors that might go into making access to food difficult.
Yeah, I guess, like, I've seen some research that says that there's no food deserts in Montreal. Mm-hmm. But what I would say is that it's not necessarily, like, it's hard to find out through statistics where a food desert is, because it really depends on individual situations, and specifically certain vulnerable groups. Like, say, if you're doing a statistical analysis on where food deserts are, and you say, "Oh, well, it's this neighborhood isn't a food desert because they have some grocery stores that are close," but think about if maybe the elderly or people who work during the hours that a grocery store is open or something like that, where it's maybe it's not a food desert for everyone, but it is for certain more vulnerable populations.
Incompatible work schedules and age are just some of the factors that can interact with and even override geographical access. Richard also talked about how traditional gender roles can interact with geography, ultimately leaving women who have close access to food with more of a burden because of the other responsibilities society has asked them to take on.
But I think that obviously the sex or the gender issue comes into it, because the people who have to go and get the food are, on the whole, more often women than men. You know, I don't want to underestimate the fact that men do, you know, men also shop, but tends to be more the women who are looking after the children and who are responsible for households. And so it does touch them more. in particular, if in a household which may have one car, and if that car is being used by the man to go to work. Now, I know that, you know, this is a bit of a caricature of a household, and things are actually a lot more complex than that. But it may have a gender dimension because of that. And you know, added to which, then if you are shopping and you have young children and you're having to walk, that is an issue. But then, you know, unless you have a store right within, you know, a couple of blocks, even 800 meters is too far really to walk with kids and shopping. So we get back to the issue of transport more than the issue of geography, but it certainly may hit women more than men.
Another social issue that geography interacts with is, of course, poverty and income level. Even though there are more affluent neighborhoods like Westmount, as Richard mentioned earlier, that could technically be considered food deserts in a geographical sense because they don't include a lot of places to buy food, they don't technically qualify because the people living there have other ways of leaving their neighborhood and accessing food. Here's Miriam talking a little bit more about how income level can affect what we qualify as a food desert in Montreal.
Well, look at different neighborhoods and determine, okay, this one is perhaps a food desert. And this. But on the other hand, I will contradict myself because the area that we chose to conduct our research was actually a neighborhood that is known for having a population that is a bit less, more impoverished than other populations in the city. And that neighborhood is Hochelaga-Maisonneuve. And it's well known that in this area, at least, there are many households with lower resources. And this is also because in the literature, and this is not a contribution of our own study, this is something that was already known before. In the literature, it said very frequently that in these areas, in neighborhoods with poor populations, they are typically targets of being food deserts. So they're more likely actually to be food deserts than other areas, which can actually be understood in a very economic sense. Because some of the stores that offer the healthiest products, let's just think of a Hype organic store or, stores in this genre, they are not necessarily attracted by neighborhoods in which people have lower purchasing power. So they will go in neighborhoods where people have high purchasing power. And this, of course, because the products are more expensive also in many instances. So, yes, in general, neighborhoods with poor populations are more likely, at least, to be food deserts than others because they are less attractive, they're less appealing to investors, to business developers, to supermarket chains, to whatever, and it then kind of create a vicious circle because they are poor, so less stores get built there, and there is less investment, and then people then have to go somewhere else and get used to that, to go somewhere else to take their car or the metro or the bus to go very far to take their food in other commercial malls or areas, and then go back to their neighborhood where still nothing, etc., etc. So it's a kind of vicious circle. And on the other hand, when you see the phenomenon of gentrification, so when the neighborhood gets more populated with richer people, then it's the other way around. So then there are more stores that actually offer a broader array of products, etc. So it's really, unfortunately, following the law of the market, I would say. So it's really a question of offer and demand, and that's also kind of an issue, I think.
If we're just looking at location, the unfortunate reality is that lower income areas are the ones that are most likely to suffer from food insecurity, and that can come from those places being considered food deserts. But we can see that other factors like the food supply outside the neighborhood, gender, and class all contribute to exacerbating food deserts. While Richard again pointed out that his research was dated, he said that if we just relied on a geographical definition, there were very few actual food deserts in Montreal.
Except for one or two very specific neighborhoods which weren't miles away, but which didn't meet our, you know, which didn't fall into our criteria. There really wasn't a food desert problem in Montreal. Now, that was 10 or 12 years ago. One of the things that really is important, and which is why basically up-to-date research is required, is that there is this concern that food stores, particularly these larger chains, actually have strategies, marketing strategies, and they may identify geographically stores which have lower revenues or which are in markets which are less lucrative, and they may rationalize, they may close stores down. So our results from 10 or 12 years ago do need to be updated regularly to make sure that the strategies of these grocery stores are not actually creating food deserts, because this is not a static picture. It is a dynamic picture which responds to imperatives of profit making by groceries, of making sure that each store is generating enough return.
Reducing food deserts to a geographical picture reduces the urgency to combat them in cities like Montreal. And the marketing strategies that Richard is talking about when it comes to placement of stores leads us into the next theme we're going to be looking at, which is supply. We're going to zoom out a little bit again to look at an English example that Richard talked to me about, which illustrates how the difficulty of food access can be multiplied by a company or store's decision not to set up a food store in a neighborhood because of that neighborhood's lower income or lower class status.
In England, certainly, there was a lot of the what's called council housing, which is social housing, was concentrated in particular neighborhoods. So there were neighborhoods of very high deprivation, which in turn mean that supermarkets can avoid them. They know where to avoid. In Canada, or in Montreal, I should say, social housing is mainly dispersed in neighborhoods. We don't have big concentrations. We just have a building, a social housing building, and then integrated into the rest of neighborhoods, which means that, yes, we have some neighborhoods which are poorer than others. There's no doubt about it. But on the whole, we don't have these very, very strong concentrations of people who require social housing, which in turn means that these stores, which are picking and choosing the neighborhoods they locate in, basically don't have a stronger reason to avoid certain neighborhoods as maybe they do in the UK. So I'm throwing this out as a hypothesis, but that certainly my knowledge of social housing and the way that the more deprived people have been geographically focused in certain neighborhoods in England, whereas they are somewhat more dispersed in Montreal. I'm not trying to say that Montreal is a nirvana of sort of mixed neighborhoods, but it is somewhat more mixed than you'd find in many British cities.
So, even though there are places where there is less access to food in Montreal, the fact that the areas that are less desirable to food corporations to turn a profit are more equally distributed makes it more difficult for a food desert to be created here because of a lack of supply. Richard pointed out there's another Montreal characteristic that combats interruptions in supply to people who need to eat.
But there's something else which may mitigate that, which is the existence in Montreal of, many places, of a lot of sort of smaller ethnic groceries or smaller fruit shops. And so although the prices there may be slightly more expensive, but not always, it's certainly, we were looking at large grocery stores because we knew that these provide a variety of good of foods. But food deserts may, particularly in the neighborhoods I was mentioning, maybe in Montreal North and some of the Hochelaga Maison Neuve, and I'm talking about a very, very few of these neighborhoods, but these were places which may have had alternative supplies of food as well. So that also needs to be looked at before we completely conclude that there is a geographic problem of access to food.
But to this, Christina added that while relying on local smaller shops is a good solution, larger businesses have access to more resources, which makes their existence more reliable. especially during times of a crisis like a global pandemic.
Yeah, and I think that also it's because food deserts have kind of been exacerbated by the proliferation of big supermarkets. And what kind of happens is that big supermarkets will come into more suburban areas, but don't move into more urban areas. And that kind of creates the absence of readily accessible, affordable food. And so instead you have smaller businesses, smaller, like say a DEP or say like a small grocery store. And those people were the only people that provide food in these areas. And these businesses have been especially impacted by the pandemic. They're not Provigo. They don't get the same level of government support and assistance, even though they're the ones that are providing services and products to people who are the most vulnerable. So I think that the pandemic's impact on small businesses and family-owned businesses in these areas has been a big contributor to maybe the creation of more food deserts.
Miriam also brought up the pandemic's impact when talking about supply. As people have started buying more things online, the problem of geographical access has been reduced, as you can just have food delivered straight to your home. This also overlaps with our final theme of education, as people who are spending more time at home are often spending that time learning more about what foods to buy and the best way to prepare them.
That's also something that I said very often, that during the pandemic, we observed a huge switch towards online commerce and online consumption. And on this aspect, at least, there is a lot of hope, because if you take a broader consideration of food desert, if people are more at home and they are more connected, and well, then it can solve in some ways the food education problem, because they can access more information, more recipes, cooking classes online. So they can actually educate themselves better, or at least they have more opportunities to do so, because they don't have to commute to go to work, they don't have to commute, to go outside to do their work or whatever. And it also, because they can actually buy everything on the internet, well, they can also buy then healthy products, provided they're not too expensive. That takes us back to the other issue of the expensiveness of products. But at least the internet and the whole digital ecosystem, whether it be through on-demand food services, food boxes that I told about you earlier, it's also part of online commerce. So sending food boxes to your home, that's through the internet very often that occurs. And you can order food, especially in Montreal. Montreal, there are a lot of food outlets all over the city. Of course, you cannot order anywhere anything, but you know, you have access, you have more access, you have companies and platforms that are helping restaurants and local producers to ship their goods throughout the city. And so in that sense, I would say that through the internet, there is a lot of hope, because it increases food education, and it also solves the product diversification, because people can have access to more diverse set of products. And it also solves the supply issue, because people don't have to physically go to a store or to an offline setting. They can just order something on the internet, and there are so many possibilities, food boxes and you name it. There are so many things that are now available on the internet. And the most crucial issue that remains is always price then. But all the other obstacles are kind of diminished.
But Just like with our other categories, this rising access to education is not true across the board. If we leave out all the other factors of why a person doesn't have access to food or education about food, there's really no start point to begin addressing a problem.
And I think that just by thinking about the people who've had more leisure during the pandemic and whose incomes have sort of been maintained, which are the sort of the white collar office workers and people who've either been working in very tough conditions or who have lost their jobs, who are tend to be people working in the low wage and low security service jobs, then I think that has probably created a problem of access to food. But again, access in a general sense, not necessarily geographic access, although geography may be a small part of that. So fundamentally, when we're looking for the future, is to think of geographic access as just one small aspect of the wider problem of access to food, which itself is one small issue of the wider problem of inequalities, particularly in the job market, I think. Because if we had good wages and more stable employment and more sensible working hours, then I don't think that access to food will be such a such an issue for some people.
When we come back from the break, we'll be examining some possible solutions to food deserts and what that may look like in the future. You're listening to CGLO, 1690 AM in Montreal. You're listening to CGLO, 1690 AM in Montreal. Hello, and welcome back to The Squeaky Curd. Today, we're looking at the concept of food deserts, and in the previous two segments, we examined how the common geographical definition of a food desert interacts with social issues that further complicates consistent access to healthy food. In this segment, we're going to be looking at ways some of these issues could be resolved. The point that we've been trying to drive home this whole time is that food deserts are not just a matter of location and geography. And to resolve them, we need to look at things beyond the scope of that lens. Here's what Christina had to say about taking a holistic approach to combating food deserts.
The hardest thing about combating food deserts is that the people that it affects are those that are most marginalized in society. And it needs political will. It needs the will of the private sector as well to address this. And I think that the hardest part is building that awareness and motivation to do something about it. And also, I guess, another of the harder things is coordination of activists, of organizations who have been working on this for years, because a lot of times organizations get caught up in what they're doing because they have to. They have to. Their services are so essential, but sometimes it's hard to look up from what you're doing and communicate with other people in order to move forward with the broader goal. And I guess also another thing is just that, like, something that always strikes me is where the government is putting its resources. Because I think Montreal has the most police officers per capita in all of Canada. And whenever I think about that and then put that in contrast with the fact that I think Montreal has the highest proportion or population of unhoused people. And you think, well, what if we used our resources differently in order to, instead of, and I get, again, it's kind of a problem of alleviation versus prevention. Maybe having more police officers on the streets or donating more money to homeless shelters or something will alleviate some of the problems, but it won't fix them from the root. And so in order to prevent this, I think that it requires a lot more investment in people and communities rather than addressing the issues later on down the line.
Here's Christina talking a little bit more about how her organization, Meal Care, tries to combat food deserts and food insecurity in Montreal.
Meal Care definitely looks to address the issues of food deserts, but also the access to healthy and nutritious and food, especially for people who are receiving food assistance from shelters and soup kitchens, stuff like that. So Meal Care was started by two McGill students, Sanchit and Milton, and they saw that the homeless population in Montreal that receives food assistance, a lot of the food isn't good. It's not fresh. It's not like a lot of shelters will make meals based on the lowest cost, not necessarily the best quality. Mm-hmm. But there's also so much food that goes to waste and food that could go into other people's hands. But what you need is the logistical transfer. And that's something that's so hard to get, is that it's just a little bit extra work on the food producer's end and no work on the recipient's end. And so what we do is we partner with McGill cafeterias and other local restaurants, small businesses, and pick up food maybe once a week, and we bring it to Old Mission Brewery. Is that the right? I think it's Old Brewery Mission. Yeah. And then they're able to serve it to their clients. Yeah. And so, yeah, so it's great because food insecurity is not a result of a shortage of food. It's a result of access to food. So helping different organizations to get access to nutritious, healthy, fresh food is what has driven Meal Care over the past, I guess, 5 years now.
As Christina mentioned, Meal Care works with all kinds of charity and food security programs across the city, like Old Brewery Mission and Wassa Montréal. She also brought up Centraide of Greater Montreal, a charity organization that is taking this multi-pronged approach to addressing poverty and access to food, as it intersects with so many issues outside of income level.
Yeah, so Centraide funds a ton of different social programs, like all across Montreal. But something that they're doing more recently is that they created a collective impact project that is specific to neighborhoods. And so it looks to address all of the intersecting factors that contribute to poverty in general. So they'll do things like identify what is the issue in specific neighborhoods. So if the issue in a specific neighborhood is the presence of a food desert, they'll set up things like affordable access to food in that neighborhood, which I think is really important to know that there's organizations in Montreal that aren't just addressing one aspect of the problem. People do see that this is like multidimensional and has a lot of like different factors that go into it. And you can't just address one factor and expect the problem to be solved. You have to do all of it at once. And that's why collective impact projects are really cool, is that they, and also really effective, is that they address all these aspects.
But of course, there's still the pandemic making it more and more difficult for people to access food and for organizations to help people who are having trouble with that access.
But these organizations have really been strained by the pandemic specifically, because it's like this catch-22 where demand for their services is increasing exponentially, and then the provision of those services, like through really crucial people like volunteers and donations, isn't happening because also these people are affected by the pandemic. But they've really like stepped up to the plate, I think, in seeing the need, and other people as well have really helped to support like food assistance in Montreal. But again, like food assistance really doesn't get to the root of the problem. You're alleviating the problem, but you're not addressing the root causes.
As we make our way to the other side of the pandemic in Canada, there is also some level of acknowledgement that it has revealed the troubling inequalities that existed in our society beforehand that contributed to food deserts. Here's some more from Christina on how to address the problems of food access at the root through the lens of the pandemic.
That's kind of an interesting one, because that's what I was kind of doing research on this past semester, seeing how the pandemic has impacted like the provision of food assistance, which is particularly important for people living in food deserts. Mm-hmm. And it's been, I think, especially detrimental to, I mean, it follows the larger pattern of the pandemic, being that the pandemic has really impacted the people that are most vulnerable rather than those who aren't. People who are already vulnerable before have been the ones that have been most impacted, which is really unfortunate. So like I was saying before, like a lot of people who are employed but also food insecure or at risk of food insecurity worked in the sectors that have lost a lot of jobs because of the pandemic. And even things like CERB and other government benefits that happened at the beginning of the pandemic, they stopped offering these assistance, like this financial assistance, even though the pandemic wasn't over, even though lockdowns still happened, even though people still didn't have the jobs that they did before.
And Miriam pointed out that from an economic perspective, difficulty accessing food will not be entirely alleviated by the end of the pandemic, as we're headed to a moment of inflation where food prices may start to go up and become even less accessible.
But it's more related to the problem of the price, the pricing of food, and what can happen, especially in a hyperinflation society, that the food products increase in price. And I'm not even just talking about the fruits and the vegetables here. I'm talking about everything. So you wouldn't even have a problem about quality food alone. You would have a problem about food in general. And I'm speaking about the problem of inflation because many economists warn about that issue in the short and the medium term, because, of course, with COVID-19, especially related to that, people lost their jobs, got into debt, and the government had to provide for them in the meantime. And of course, money doesn't come from nowhere. So it was printed and it was given to people for free. But the problem with that is it can continue. It can continue like that. It can go on for a very long time because we have to catch up economically. And in the meantime, when there is so much more money in the economy, then most of the time the basic food products tend to increase, at least the price tend to increase. And if that's the case, then it's not just a problem of quality food, it's a problem of food in itself. And food deserts actually can become much... well, it's not even an issue of food deserts in that case. There might be some stores, but the prices just will be so high that people cannot purchase food anymore. So that's also a problem. But I would say that it's more not a long-term problem, but it's more a medium-term, something that happens with time. Mm-hmm. But we already saw a little bit of it. We already saw a little bit of that in the recent months. We saw the prices of some items go up, and that's a big challenge, of course.
The need for multifaceted early root action to combat food deserts exists because they are multifaceted issues that don't just begin and end with, I live in this neighborhood, there aren't enough food stores near me. There are definitely neighborhoods where there is less access to nutritious food. But the idea that there are maybe very few food deserts in Montreal needs to be taken in with the additional fact that more things go into access to food besides just where you live.
But nevertheless, the question of food deserts is partly one of thinking carefully about what the problem is. And the problem is not, I think, fundamentally a geographic problem. The problem is more of a socioeconomic issue to do with people having access to good transport, people having access to the knowledge and the time to prepare good food.
Thank you for listening to The Squeaky Curd. Today's episode wouldn't have been possible without the participation of Richard Schirmer, Miriam Ertz, and Christina Wolf. To learn more about meal care, please visit mealcare.org. If you or someone you know is experiencing food insecurity, or you want to find a place to take food donations, please consult the Montreal Food Resources Sheet, compiled by the People's Potato, on the Squeaky Curd's show page. Our show illustration and logo were designed by Christina Rivera. Please join us next time as we take a look at recent efforts to preserve Montreal's Chinatown. From Gwen Rowley, you're listening to CGLO 1690 AM in Montreal.